Okay, well, Kufar, Akbar, everybody, hello. Welcome to Radio Free Kafiristan. This is a radio program dedicated to rightly dividing the truth between Christianity and Islam. I'm trying to do two things here at one time, and you know me in multitasking. I am absolutely miserable at it. Somebody's mic is hot here. I think that's you, Rad. Yeah, that was Rad's mic is hot. So, Rad, when you want to come up on mic, you're just going to have to unmute yourself. We like to welcome the co-host tonight for showing up just on time, the nick of time, Mr. Claus. Okay, so on this show, what do we do on the show? On this show, we examine the evidence for both of the faiths in order to arrive at the truth that leads us to the sun. Thus go I and we. I need to update that here on my show notes. Anyway, so peace and blessings to you. This, of course, is your humble host, Eric Seckerford, coming to you live from the cavernous depths of the Kafir Cave in Dar al-Harb, Kafiristan. We are here every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. Central Standard Time, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And now for our peeps out on the West Coast, I don't believe they sprung ahead, so now they are 2 hours, if I'm not mistaken. So it is 5 o'clock here, so it would be 3 o'clock there. So they're 2 hours behind us. We are, again, broadcasting on the Global Patriot Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio. We are on StreamYard, where we broadcast to our two Facebook pages, Crossing the Crest Discussion Group and Radio Free Kafiristan. And, of course, we broadcast straight to YouTube. And I see we got some people in YouTube chat. Thank you, people, for coming. And then that is uploaded. We live a complicated life around here. That's uploaded to the crossandthecrescent.com. Crossandthecrescent.com. That is our website where we keep all of these videos in store for everybody. Now, you need to remember that a Kafir, and we had this discussion on Sunday when our friend Mujay brought up the word Kafir. A Kafir is someone who does not heed the beliefs and prescriptions held by the religion of Islam. And I was able to give him a byword, verbatim definition of that because I say it every single week here because this is according to the new encyclopedia of Islam. And of course, Kafiristan is a play on words, and we say it is Dar al-Harb, the house of war, where there is no Sharia Islamia. Now, that is compared to the other places, which are Dar al-Salam or the house of peace or something like that. John Isaac can fix me if I'm broke on that. But those are in the lands like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, etc., stand in the Sukkistans, where you have the Sharia reigning. If you want to call into the show, the call-in number is area code 319-527-6706, area code 319-527-6706. Okay, so I got the intro out of the way. I wanted to bounce over to the Blog Talk Radio to make sure that I had that set up there right, and it is going correctly. I got 50 screens here. I just need to quit making life so complicated. Okay, so welcome, Mr. Claus. How are you this evening? I see you got a new avatar. It's the big OC. You know what you should do? Chris, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. You know what you should do is that C, you should put a 2 as an exponent up in the corner.
You should,
yeah, 2 C squared, right, yeah. Good, Chris Claus. That'd be even cooler. You know, every now and then, you know, I was telling you the other day, I've never had an original idea in my life. Well, there you go. There it is, right? Don't get used to it. That's your idea. Take it from the artistic side of me where we do these things. Okay, so tonight we are talking about why should somebody convert to Christianity? And we're going to approach this by in two different ways. The first one we're going to have is a theological reason why somebody should convert to Christianity. And then what I plan to do is I am going to take it from a historical or fact-based perspective. Why should you convert to Christianity? Because of the facts, not the theological belief system that is involved in it, but what facts are there that could support your idea or your desire to convert to Christianity? So we're going to let Chris take the mic, and he can walk us through the theological perspective of this. Who did we lose? We just lost Chris. How could we just lose Chris? Now, I'm not exactly sure what he is doing up there in Canada. John, is there anything going on up there where you guys are having like some type of northern lights or disrupting the signal?
No, nothing. Normal.
Okay, well, I...
Some problems with the internet. Internet,
okay, well, it looks like he made it back. And he did change his avatar. I want to tell you something also, Mr. Claus, now that you're back, that when I went to stop my cam today, when I was, Rad and I were having a conversation prior to the show, and when I stopped my camera, I noticed that my icon had your mug on there.
Because I had to sign into yours so that I could get the... When I signed into yours when I ran the show for those 2 days when I signed in, I changed it over to mine.
That's okay. Well, I was looking at that. I'm like, wait a second, that's not me. And then so I had to I switched it back. So I see my wonderful face there now. Okay, so, Chris, you're not having any connectivity issues up there, are you? Or?
No, actually, it was just I was on my phone because I was going through a few different things. And I finally got home. I got to my computer finally. Hopefully I was just looking up the
what, your notes? Yeah. Did you take notes?
Well, I was looking up the notes that I did have here.
They look something like this. I got like 8 pages of stuff that I put together yesterday. I'm out of control.
It does. So can you start with the historical, and then I'll jump into the theological after?
I can. I most
so
certainly
can.
Get
my stuff ready.
Okay. Thank yeah. You. No problem at all. Okay. So the question that we pose tonight is, why should somebody convert to Christianity? Now, Chris is going to go ahead, and he's going to tackle the theological reasons behind that. But tonight, I want to just start with the historical reality of the Christian faith. And I went in and I did a little looking. This isn't my original thoughts. I was telling Chris that I don't have an original thought in my life other than telling him to put a 2 on his C. I went in and I went to a website called Cold Case Christianity. And this was the guy that runs this place. His name's J. Warner Wallace. He's a very popular Christian apologist. Used to be, I'm out of control. You wouldn't now, Dragon. You sometimes I am out of control. But J. Warner Wallace is a very brilliant man. Used to be an investigator, I think, for the Los Angeles Police Department. Used to handle cold cases. You know, the type of cases that have been out of date for years, and you know, some of the witnesses have died, or even you know, your primary witnesses have died. So if you go to his website, I don't mean to promote his website, but he has a really good website. It's called Cold Case Christianity. And what he did was he basically sits down 4 separate principles to determine ancient historical reliability. And just listen real quick what these 4 principles are, and we'll kind of go through them really quick. But one of them, the first one, of course, is make sure that the witnesses were present for the event in the first place. That would be kind of important. You don't want, let's say, Charlemagne, who lived in, the 9th century, commenting on exactly what happened at the cross. Why? Because he wasn't there. We know he wasn't there. The second thing is try to find some outside corroboration, trying to corroborate or provide some type of validity to the event itself. Third, examine the consistency and the accuracy of the witnesses. Make sure that they're telling a consistent and accurate story. And this is always a big one with Muslims here because look at the Gospels. They differ so radically. No, they don't. But remember, the main thing that they discuss is all 4 Gospels saw what? All 4 Gospels say that Jesus died on a cross. Imagine that. What does the Quran say? Didn't happen. So there's a big difference right there. And then lastly, the 4th one is examine the presence of bias on the part of the witnesses. So let's just start with the first one here. Make sure the witnesses were present at the event. And what we've done is we've looked at the dating of the Gospels before to make sure that the Gospels were written early enough from the event that they portend to opine upon, which they comment upon, which they're talking about, that they're written early enough to be considered eyewitness events. So when we look at the dating, when we date the Gospels, all four Gospels can easily be dated within the lifetime of the apostles. Now, let's start with Matthew. Matthew, the modern scholarship, and I'm not talking about the previous scholarship that was done back in the early 20th, late 19th century that dates the, that pushed the dates of the Gospels, let's say John clear out to 90 AD and pushing Matthew, Mark, and Luke out into late 70s, early 80s AD. I'm talking about the modern scholarship that follows the bouncing ball here, because when we start talking about dating the Gospel of Mark, dating the Gospel of Matthew, dating the Gospel of Luke, we can really determine that these three Gospels themselves, just the Synoptic Gospels, were written very early. And the reason why we can do that is because we know that Mark wrote the book of Acts. Now, the book of Acts, if you read the book of Acts, which most Muslims won't do, but if you read the book of Acts ends with Paul in prison before he is martyred for his faith. Now, we know this is 64 AD. So we know the book of Acts is written before 64 AD, because if Paul had already been killed, it most certainly would have been mentioned that. And the same thing with Peter, because Peter was martyred, I believe it was the following year. It would have mentioned Peter's martyrdom also, but it doesn't. The other thing that we know about the book of Acts is that it relies heavily on Mark. It has all kinds of Markean passages within it. So it used Mark as part of its own gospel. So that means, you guess it, you know, follow the bouncing ball, that means that Mark had to be written prior to Luke. Okay, so Acts is written after the Gospel of Luke. So we know that Luke was written before Acts. Luke draws heavily on Mark, so we know that Mark is before Acts now. So there are some of the new scholarship and most recent scholarship is pushing Mark clear back about 45 AD, which would be within 13 years of the cross, 12, 13 years of the cross. That's pretty recent. So when we talk about when they were written early enough to be written by true eyewitnesses, and that's what we're able to ascertain here. Matthew, and there's all kinds of internal evidence within the Gospel of Matthew to demonstrate that it was Matthew's writing than just about any of the other Gospels. Now, if you were to go ahead and compare that to, oh, I don't know, the Hadith and the Quran, well, when we look at the Quran, we find all kinds of stories that pre-exist the Quran in the Quran being passed off as divine revelations from God. We find passages from Jewish Midrash or Jewish Talmudic writings. We find passages and stories from Gnostic Gospels. I mean, Jesus speaking from the cradle. That's as Gnostic as you can get. We find also in their Syriac folklore within the Quran. But then if you go to the Hadith, the Ahadith, number one, this is an oral tradition and would not be admissible in a court of law. Whereas if you take the Gospels, which are considered eyewitness written testimony, they would be acceptable in a court of law. On top of that, the Hadith were not written down, collected, until over 200 years after the death of Muhammad. So you have somebody quoting what Muhammad did, what Muhammad said 200 years after his life. How does that work out? How trustworthy is that? Well, it's awful trustworthy because they'll say that they're Sahih, Bukhari, and Muslim. Well, if you look at where they live, Bukhari lives almost 1,000 miles away from Mecca that existed in the south. There's so many different places I go with it, so I'm just going to stay away from that. Okay, so they had to be written early, circulated early, and the possibility of errant or deceptive inclusion is greatly reduced. Okay, early authorships allows the accounts to be fact-checked, meaning that the people who lived at this time can fact-check what the gospel message was. Principle two, try to find some corroboration for the claims of the witnesses. And here's where you would have external corroboration, not only in written testimony, but in archaeology. So when it starts talking about how Nazareth is in northern Israel and how the Sea of Galilee flows into the Dead Sea and places Jerusalem in the mountains, when you look at geography, the New Testament is accurate. Specifically, when you look at Luke, Luke is really good at getting all of the details correct. You would also look for, oh, I don't know, the city of Jerusalem, you know, God's holy city where the Jews have lived for, well, up to this point, 1,400 years. Yeah, that little place. And that place is not mentioned one time in the Quran for some reason. So you would also look at other geographical locations. The people are internally confirmed as far as, you know, let's say Caiaphas, that has been confirmed that he was the chief priest at the time. So there's all kinds of external confirmations for the Bible. Compare that to the Quran, not so much. You don't have any confirmation. Muhammad's mentioned one time in the Quran. Mecca is mentioned one time in the Quran. And we actually talked about that on this show. And I believe that, I don't know if it was John or if it was Adam, where you guys showed us how if you just put like a little squiggly dash on that first letter, like a circle on the end of it, if I'm not mistaken, it changes the name from Mecca to Becca. Am I right?
True.
Okay.
True. It's written in the Quran nowadays like Becca with a dot down the letter. If we continue the circle passing with the dot, it will be Mecca. Then the difference is very, very little.
So it's just one little. And let's make sure that we understand this, that it starts off with Becca, but when they add, not take away, but when they add that circle, like the thing,
semicircle or something, it will be Mecca.
Right. Okay. So it changes it. So all they had to do is just add that. So I'm not saying that they did, but it could have been awful easy to do that. Okay, so let's see here. No contemporaneous accounts for Muhammad. Nobody that lived at the time of Muhammad wrote about Muhammad. Nobody. The earliest person that writes about Muhammad is a guy by the name of Ibn, lives a century after Muhammad. And we're supposed to believe that he's Muhammad's biographer. And we don't even have anything that Ishaq wrote either, as a matter of fact. There's nothing out there that Ishaq wrote. We get our information from Ibn Hisham. Ibn Hisham. And maybe I got him backwards. It doesn't really matter, because Ibn Hisham doesn't come for another 100 years after Ishaq. So for 200 years, we don't get anything about Muhammad's life. For 200 years, we don't get in his biography. And then for 200 years, we don't get anything from a hadith either. But Christians are criticized about, well, we don't have anything on the originals, the Gospels. Well, you don't have anything original either, gunfighter. And then the worst part about it is if you check Quranic geography, oh, by the way, which Dan Gibson does a really good job of. I got that the right way? If it doesn't, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, the description of Mecca in the Quran and in the Hadith literature, completely different than what we find in Mecca. I mean, they're talking about having vineyards in Mecca. Have you ever seen Mecca? Mecca is like one big rock that's dusty, and that's it. So you're not going to have any rocks there. Okay, so principle three. I only got four principles, but I got like eight other pages of notes that we can bring up if you guys want to do this. Is there somebody in there? I'm trying to look over a chat. Okay, number three, examine the consistency and the accuracy of the witnesses. Chain of custody is related to the transmission is very important here. If you look at the Gospels are the best attested and collective ancient documents in history. We have people attesting to the authorship and the contents of the Gospels from people who were contemporaneous to the apostles. What do I mean by that? Clement of Rome, contemporaneous to Paul and Peter when they were in Rome. Then you have Polycarp, Ignatius, or not Ignatius, Irenaeus, I'm sorry, I get those two mixed up, but it doesn't matter. And then you have Papias. All of those guys were contemporaneous to the Apostle John. And we have their writings that attest to the authorship, this chain of custody that J. Warner Wallace talks about that is necessary in order to prove the validity of a piece of evidence. For example, if you go to a crime scene and you have somebody throw down a gun or the gun's there that committed a crime, you have to collect up that gun, bag it, tag it, and then you have a document that says, okay, you collected it, and then you take it to the person that's in the evidence room. They have to sign for it, and there has to be a chain of custody every single day when they go through there. So you have the same thing here. You have the same thing here with the Gospels. Okay, let's see. We're going to – okay, we got Josephus. They all know about these messages. Okay, four – principle number four, and then I'm going to let Chris have at it. Chris, did you find your file? This is my last point. I just wanted to see if you were ready. Chris Claus, C squared, are you there? Is he muted?
Who's that, me?
Well, I was just seeing if you're ready to roll, because I'm on my last point.
Oh, yeah, I'm good.
Okay, just making sure. Okay, examine the presence of bias on the part of the witnesses. Okay, now a lot of people will criticize the authorship or the authors of the Gospels, saying that they were biased and they had something to gain. I would ask, what did the Gospel writers possibly have to gain by preaching what they had seen with their eyes and felt with their hands? What did they have to gain? This, I mean, he talks about you have three different things that people normally will, where their biases will come out, where they have to gain sexual or sensual acts, power, and financial greed. So when we look down at the motives for the apostles, what mode did they have? Any of those biases? Any of those motives at all? And of course, the answer is no. All of them, with the exception of John, went to their death proclaiming what they knew, not what they believed, but what they knew to be true, what they had seen with their own eyes. So to say that they made it up because they wanted, you know, some type of gain? Are you kidding me? They were all killed for their faith. Now compare that to Muhammad.
I'm sorry, let me just interject here on this really quickly.
Okay.
Okay, so dying for what you believe does not prove what you believe is correct, but it definitely proves you believe what you are dying for. Do you see what I'm saying?
Okay? It's true, absolutely true.
All right. And that is a serious thing. In other words, you know, well, okay, look at Nazi concentration camp. I've been watching a lot of the videos lately. And they have the special operations group or whatever. These were Jews that were put in charge of, disposing of the bodies, right?
Commandos. They called them commandos. Capos and commandos, right?
Yeah, that's how I find that funny. Special operations. Commandos. Yeah. No, that's where that comes from. Anyway, okay? Now think about this, okay? The first job of these commandos was to strip the bodies of their predecessors, the ones they were replacing, strip their bodies of clothing and burn them. That was their first job because they were only to survive for 4 months and it would get others to do it, okay? Now, here's the thing. You can intimidate someone, okay, and keep them alive. That means, you know what, they don't really kind of believe. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, you can intimidate someone for death, even though they know death is only for an additional 4 months, okay, and keep them alive and make them do horrible things. Whereas a person who actually believes in the opposite of this or believes in the supernatural life, do you see what I'm saying? Okay? They wouldn't do that. They'd be just like, kill me now, dude. What's the point? You see what I'm saying? Okay? Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay. I mean, when you read Eli Wiesel's book, Night, that's one of the things that he points out. You know, why are people prolonging the ultimate outcome, which is death, for, you know, just, you know, a bowl of soup or, you know, a chunk of bread. And it's actually really sad. And this, you know, I teach this in my exploratory class. Is we go through the book night. We read the whole thing, and we got all, you know, it's a lot of fun. And there's one more thing that I wanted to add to what you said, Rad, which is very important. The apostle, because, you know, people die all the time for what they believe in. I mean, you look at jihadis. They'll go out and they'll blow themselves up because why? They believe that this is their one-way ticket to paradise, that you know, they don't have to, you know, stop at Go and collect their $200. They're right there with Allah, or actually not Allah, but you know what I'm saying. Okay, that's what they believe. But is that what they know? No, it's what they believe. Now, compared to that with the apostles would be there to know whether or not what they were preaching was true or not. Not what they believed, but what they knew. And they knew that Jesus had been crucified on a cross, and they knew that Jesus was walking around 3 days later. And if somebody did that in front of me, I'm going to tell a couple people about it, because I am going to be dramatically changed by it. When you see somebody come back from the dead like that, you're going to want to tell the world about it. And that's what they did. And they all went to their death proclaiming this, with the exception of John. So when we look at the criteria for the historicity of the Gospels, and I just got through one page. I got seven more, but I'm going to bore you to death if I don't let Chris come on. Did somebody have something to add? I see Connie's coming up on mic. Connie, did you have something to add before we get to Chris?
No, I was just really agreeing with you here. Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate you.
The only thing that I'd say, before I jump into what I was going to say, Eric, is I definitely agree with what you're saying about what the disciples actually knew. Because one of the most famous agnostic atheists out there, Bart Ehrman, he was asked a question about if he believed that the disciples actually saw the risen Jesus and whatnot. And he says that, of course, he doesn't believe in supernatural, so maybe he's an atheist. But he does actually believe that the apostles believed that they did see the risen Jesus. Mm-hmm. So even Bart Ehrman actually affirms that the apostles actually believed and they knew that they've actually saw the risen Jesus. So I'll take the apostles' account instead of Bart Ehrman's account over it, of course. So, yeah, definitely. Thank you very much. That was awesome. So my belief in the Bible is that it contains the revelation given to the prophets. I also believe that God has given the prophets the ability to add their own words in certain places and circumstances. We must remember that the Bible is not just revelation, but historical information as well. I also would admit that the ancient documents over time may, many different copyings attempt have errors in them. This is true for every document that is produced has errors within 1,000 years. Now, we can go over those variants. I have a whole other paper on that. I'm not going to get into it. The way I would like to look at which text is from God, of course, the Quran and the Bible, is to look at the truthfulness of the revelation, and the revelation given can provide, and if the revelation given can provide salvation. So again, hopefully it's up to everybody out there, but I'm hoping that they do accept the Bible as the only means of knowledge to obtain salvation. Of course, the Quran has no salvific information in it whatsoever. It's completely the opposite. So I will provide a positive case for the Bible being truthful in its revelations, as well as the way the Bible is the only religious text to provide a way to salvation, and also showing that the Quran is not truthful in its revelations, nor does it provide a way to salvation. Now, there are a couple different ways one can judge whether something is true or not. One way you can tell if a revelation is true or not, true is if it is historically proven and if this revelation comes true. So the whole reason for the revelation of the Bible is for God to be able to make himself known to his creation and provide his creation with laws to live by in a way to obtain salvation. In the Bible, it starts off with God providing information to his creation that he is the one that created them. He describes how they were created and why they were created. Now, there are many revelations that we could talk about, but because there's only a couple hours here and the Bible's big, I'll only address a few of the messianic prophecies of the Bible and show how they are true and fulfilled through Jesus. Of course, the Messiah being born from a virgin woman. You can go right back to Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. It says there, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring, and he will bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Isaiah 7:14 also states, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and call his name Emmanuel. Now, when we go to Matthew chapter 1, verse 20, we can see, but after he had considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because it was conceived in her, what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. In Matthew 22, or keep going on to 22 and 23, all this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel. And then just stopping here at Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, but when the set time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, under the law. Right. So that takes care of the Messiah would be born from a woman. Now, I'm going to move into the Messiah would be the heir of King David's throne. You can go to 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 to 13. Now, there's many places you can go to. I'm just pulling out a few verses just for time's sake here. So 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12 to 13, it says, when your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Isaiah 9:7, of the greatness of the government and the peace that will be to no end, he will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Now, when we go to the New Testament, we can see that in Romans chapter 1, verse 13, it says regarding his son, who as to his earthly life was a descendant of David. And then Luke chapter 1, verses 32 to 33, it says, and he will be great, and he will be called Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over Jacob's descendants forever. His kingdom will have no end, will never end. Now, lastly, I just want to address how the Messiah would be treated. And for this, I'm not going to read all of it, but I will read a lot of Isaiah 53, starting right at the start. Well, not quite at the start. I think it's like 2 or 3. He was despised and abandoned by men, a man of great pain, and familiar with sickness, and like one from people who hid their faces, he was despised, and he had no regard for him. However, it was our sickness that he had bore himself, and our pains that carried him. Yet we ourselves assumed him that he had been afflicted. This is a bad translation. Just give me one second here. I'm going to find a different translation here. That was a really bad one that I had. I'm not even sure what was going on there. All right, so here we go. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering with familiar with pain, like one whom from people, that's where I got it from. It's an NIV one. No, don't read the NIV. Let's go to the NET or NET. Just give me one second here, people. Sorry about this. This is this is how great we are here. This is the professionalism. So starting with verse 4, but he lifted up our illness, carried our pain. Even though we thought he was being punished, attacked by God and afflicted for something he had done, he was wounded because of our rebellious deeds, crushed because of our sins. He endured punishment that made us heal. And because of his wounds, we were healed. So again, this is the Isaiah 53, the suffering servant. This is where Jesus took our punishment and bore our punishment upon the cross. Now, all we have to do is point to the crucifixion, where Jesus, of course, was whipped, beaten almost to the point of death, and then put up on the cross, where he did die and then raised on the third day. So just by the prophecy being fulfilled, we can assure that the revelation is from God and is true. As I said above, the religious text also provides a way to salvation, and here's the process in the Bible. Now, what it is here is I found this song. It was by a man named Bizzle. He's a hip-hop artist, but he is a Christian artist. And he wrote a song called The Gospel. So I took down the lyrics just so I could read it for everybody today, just so we don't have any copyright infringements, right? So it starts off, nothing was an accident. It all has a purpose. Now back to the beginning at the fall. Man sins, tries to fix it on his own, but God covers him with skins. But he never says what animal he's getting it from. All we know is to cover man, he shed innocent blood. Now remember Cain and Abel. Cain's offer was rejected. You ever wonder why Abel's offer was accepted? All I know is Cain offered the work of his hand. Abel tended the sheep, so he must have offered a lamb. Now look at Abraham and Isaac. Are you seeing it now? A ram in the bush to take the place of his child? Because Abraham had faith enough to give up his son, God would later do the same, that the forgiveness would come. Back to the Passover, oh man, here it comes with the lamb again. The innocent blood of the lamb is covering man again. You don't see the pattern and get what it means? And then it all becomes clear when Jesus steps on the scene. And now he changes it from telling a story about the Old Testament to jumping into the New Testament. And he words it as if Jesus is the one speaking here. So just accept the words as if Jesus was the one speaking them, and I'm pretty sure that this is what Jesus would say anyways. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I am the Lamb without blemish, sacrificed for your sin. The Lamb of God without sin, little children understand, you can't do it on your own. It is me who covers man. I'm the one who took your place when death lifted up his hand, gave you righteousness for faith. You're the one who broke the law, but it was I he sent to pay. I gave my life for those who hate me, and I went quietly, and I didn't even try to beat the case. I'm the offer he accepts when your works get rejected. I'm the one who pleads your case before the judge in heaven. I knew you were guilty, but loved you enough to serve your sentence. The wages of sin is death, and I died to expunge your record. See, I am the Passover. The wrath of God is waiting. Every life not covered by the blood will be taken. I am the way, the truth, and the life, and I will always be. I am, beloved. It was always. So as Jesus is saying in this, that he is the one that took upon our sins, and he is the one that he is the great I am that is sending this all into motion. So I believe it's a very beautiful song. I think everybody should, if you get time, to go ahead and take a look at it. Now, going over to God's plan for salvation, for God had a plan for salvation that would presuppose that we need salvation. So we need salvation because we are sinful creatures by nature, and this is what we need help from. If we go to Psalms 51:5, we see that David said that, behold, he was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin his mother did conceive him. We can go to Ecclesiastes 7:20. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. 1 John 1 verse 8, it says, if we say we have no sin, deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. And Romans chapter 3, verse 23, for all have sinned and fell short of the glory of God. But through Israel being the light to the nations, all nations would be saved, right? Isaiah 42, verse 6, it says, I'm the Lord, have called you in righteousness, and I will keep by the hand and keep you, and I will give you as a covenant for the people and a light for the nations. Isaiah 49, verse 6, and he says, it is too light of a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and bring them back preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light to the nations that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. So this isn't just for Israel. This is for all nations. And of course, Isaiah 52:10, it says that the Lord has bared his holy arm before his eyes of all nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. So who is this light? And we can go to John chapter 8, verse 12. And again, Jesus spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world, that whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Acts 13:47 says, so for the Lord has commanded us, saying, I have made you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring salvation to the ends of the earth. Acts 26, verse 22 to 23, to this day I have had help that comes from God. And so I stand here testifying both to small and to great, saying nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would come to pass, that the Christ must suffer, and that by being the first to rise from the dead, he would proclaim light both to our people and to the Gentiles. So, of course, we see that in the Old Testament, God had planned for his Messiah to be the light of the nations, that through him all nations would be saved. This is affirmed in the New Testament, where it identifies Jesus as the Messiah that is this light to all nations. So the next logical question would be, why Jesus? In God's plan of salvation, God himself is the only one who can provide our salvation. We utterly are unable to save ourselves because of our sin and its consequences. God became one of us in the person of Jesus Christ, John chapter 1, verse 1 to 14. Jesus lived a sinful life, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21, Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15, and offered himself as a perfect sacrifice on our behalf, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 3, and Colossians chapter 1, verse 22. Since Jesus is God, his death was of infinite and eternal value. The death of Jesus on the cross fully paid for the sins of the entire world. 1 John chapter 2, verse 2. His resurrection from the dead demonstrated that his sacrifice was indeed sufficient and salvation is now available. So now that we have a complete plan from God for the salvation of humanity, why would there be any need of an Arabic prophet, or any prophet for that matter, right? The only one we need is the promised comforter, the Holy Spirit, who will abide in us forever and bring to knowledge everything that Jesus taught. So my Muslim friends out there, my question is to you, why should any Christian accept any other prophet who did not teach the exact same plan for salvation as the biblical God? And that's basically all I had. I just wanted to go through certain revelations to show that the Bible, the fulfillment and the accuracy of them, and also wanted to show that the Bible does have a plan for salvation and that Jesus is the only way to that salvation. So through the theological understanding of this, we have a complete view of what God has provided us, right from why we were created to why we need salvation. We don't have this in any other religion except Christianity, and this is why one should accept Christianity. Like Troll on 100 right there.
I was just waiting. need to hit that button because you were on such a roll. All right, I would just add one thing to what you said, because you did mention the verse, Isaiah 9:6, and in Isaiah 9:6 it says, "For a child will be born unto us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace." Almost all Jewish expositors believe this is a verse that is messianic. And this verse fits Christ perfectly. And so when you ask, well, where do we, you know, it's like a blind man or a thief looking for a cop. Is that you're never going to find it unless you're absolutely honest in wanting to find the truth. And this right here, it says, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, a son will be given to us. And then you flip that over and you go to Titus chapter 2, verse 13, looking for the blessed hope and the appearing of the glory of our who? Great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. So when we start looking, where does the Bible, where does the New Testament teach that Jesus is God? And when we look at this from a theological perspective or a vantage point like Chris provided here, it's very clear that not only the Old Testament taught, but also what the New Testament teaches.
Yeah, and before you go too far on that, the word for mighty God used in Isaiah 9:6 is actually El Gibor.
Right.
And if you go one more chapter over into Isaiah 10, El Gibor is used in verse, I believe it is 21. It says here in Isaiah 10, verse 21, a remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. Again, this is a reference to Yahweh. Most Hebrew-speaking individuals will realize that the tense of El Gibor is actually only used in reference to God. El Giborim is used for mighty men, but El Gibor is only used for God.
Okay. Uh-oh. Esau wants to come on. Are we going to let Esau in the house? I forgot to send him an invite. Let me send him an invite real quick. I forgot to mention this at the beginning of the show. On Sunday, this past Sunday, we had what was that guy's name again? Muji was on the show on Sunday, and I talked to Chris offline, and I talked to Robert offline about this, and I think I've mentioned this to Connie, that you know I hate to admit this, but I was actually feeling kind of sorry for him. And the reason why is because there were so many people that wanted to question him. And he was trying to answer questions from, you know, all over the place. Now, I believe, now before I get myself in trouble with the audience here, I believe that he was talking in circles. It was just so frustrating trying to get a straight answer out of this guy. And I get the level of frustration, and I mentioned this to these other folks that I, you know, looking back in retrospect, I probably should have cut the guy off at the 20-minute mark because I could tell that the show was going absolutely nowhere. However, I didn't, and this is what the outcome was, and it just was it was like a dumpster fire is what it was. So what we're going to do is when I send out these invites for the show, if you don't get an invite for the show, it's not because I don't like you. It's not because I don't want you to come on to the show. The reason is that if we get too many people in the chat and we got everybody wanting to say something, it makes the show kind of go in too many different directions. So we want to keep it focused. And if you think that there's something that you can or want to add to the show, I want you to contribute to the show. I do want you to come on, but you need to notify me, just like Muji. Thank you, Issa. And Issa, I just sent you that link in instant message, so you can click there and come on. We do want you to come on. It's just that we just don't want it to get to be so chaotic like it was on Sunday, because
we don't mind pulling people on one at a time, and and discussing with them like that. We just don't want to have nine people all in at one time.
And then plus we have to listen to Robert. I'm kidding.
The rabbit brain.
I don't know if he's there or not, but he's muted right now. But we always we love having you guys on, and I really like listening to what you have to say. Now, I did see that Connie had something that you wanted to share your screen with. Is there something there?
Yes, the question is why convert to Christianity, okay? Okay, so let me find this page again. And I'm just gonna show the Islamic source that it answers this question, okay?
An Islamic source. Okay, hold on. Let me get this right. You're gonna show me an Islamic source. Okay.
Yes. Islamic. Actually, it's an ayah. An Islamic ayah.
Okay. Is this from the Injil or is this from?
No.
Oh, okay.
From the Quran.
Okay.
Okay.
Darn it, I was hoping Connie found it.
Yep. What's that?
The Injil. We're all looking for this Injil. Right,
I
yeah.
I have. It is the Bible. Because Sahih Muslim 27:13a tells us the Torah and the Injil is, in parentheses, Bible. Okay, so here it is. Okay. So you see that there? There it is for you.
Okay, let me share that.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, you're on.
Because in Christianity, even the Quran says that we have a divine writ. So it's saying, produce then that divine writ of yours if you are speaking the truth. And we do. So why convert to Christianity? Well, the Quran even testifies to Christianity, saying that we have our divine writ. It's divine. It's inspired. It is holy. Holy Scripture says in a hadith. I don't know which one it is, but this one I just wanted to start with.
Okay, so this is from Sahih, meaning that it is supposed to be authentic, even though it was written down 200 years.
This is the Quran.
Oh, I was looking at the bottom where it says Sahih. Okay.
Yes, down here. So, the Torah and the Injil, Bible. It says Bible. The Injil is Bible. The Torah is Bible. And this is in Sahih Muslim 27:13a.
You know, I was looking at a post on Facebook this morning, and the argument is that the Bible doesn't say Bible in the Bible, so the Bible can't be true. And I'm thinking, what an absurd argument. And, you know, when you look at it, it's not even an accurate argument to say that the word Bible is not in the Bible, because making it not true, because the word Bible means book, and the word book is written all over the Bible. So that's just, you know, some of these arguments that we get are just, they're just acts of desperation.
Dumb.
Yeah, they're dumb. They're,
call them what they are, dumb.
I don't want to, okay, well...
Okay,
they're stupid. That's right. I agree. They are. But, I mean, they're just completely irrational and reek with desperation, for crying out loud.
Yeah. Even Jesus says the Biblos of Moses. So the Bible of Moses. I did a whole big picture on that, too. How many times Jesus said Bible.
Well, if you go back to Genesis, it's right there. If you open up Genesis chapter 5, it says, this is the Bible of the descendants of Adam, and this is the book. Okay, so there you go. There's your answer. I don't get some of these arguments. Well, I do get them, because what they have to do is they have to somehow provide an excuse as to why the Quran contradicts the book, that very book that it claims to come to confirm. Well, we got a lot of people in chat today, and I just wanted to give a real quick shout out, and then you can come up. We got Deuce Vault. I don't know what that means, but thank you for coming. XYZ is here. Ben Christian is here. Pierce Taylor. You guys have been here the last couple shows, and we appreciate you so much. Animals here. Dragon Daenerys as the moderator there. And we appreciate that. And Isaf made his way here. And there was a couple other ones, if I'm not mistaken. If I miss you, I apologize. But we appreciate all of you people that are tap dancing Muslims. I think that's my kufar phobia friend. I might be wrong on that, but that's okay. And then Majesty Hype was here. And then Connie, you were over there, it looks like, too. Heaven Bang came. Thank you for coming. All right, Chris, go on ahead. I just want to make sure we acknowledge everybody here. Go ahead.
Like Connie has said, the Quran actually affirms our scriptures. And it affirms that our scriptures cannot be corrupted. So a Muslim has to accept our scriptures, or they're denying what their God has actually said, because all of us that have heard Muslims say that no one can change the words of Allah, right? So therefore, if in fact we see, and we do, that Allah revealed the previous scriptures, they cannot be corrupted because they cannot be changed. And if you go to early Islamic commentators, you can go to Ibn Kathir and the rest of them, they actually affirm this, that the actual wording in the Torah and the Injil did not change, but it was the meaning of the word that the people were changing, which was why they were saying that it was corrupted. So the earliest commentators of the Quran denied the argument that the Bible was corrupted. The only argument that they had is that the people that were preaching from the Bible were corrupting the meaning of it when they were saying it, but the words remained the same.
Okay, I wanted to add to that as far as, you know, the validity of the Bible and how and what people think about that. I also want to give a shout out to Annie, the Southern Sansar radio chick. She has her own shows on Blog Talk Radio also. Slam RN showed up today. And also I wanted to point out that Deuce Vault is Nim Grace 1.5. So evidently I got that straight. Okay, I want to read a quote from F.F. Bruce. Now, F.F. Bruce is one of the greatest biblical historians within the last century or so. And this is what he writes about the New Testament. He says, the evidence of our New Testament writings is ever so much greater than the evidence for many writings of classical author, the authenticity of which no one dreams questioning. Hold on, let me restate that again. The authenticity no one dreams questioning. Unless you're a desperate follower of a false prophet, maybe then, he doesn't write that, but maybe then you would. And if the New Testament were a collection of secular writings, their authenticity would be generally regarded as beyond all doubt. What is he saying, and why does he say that? He's saying that if we were to look at the New Testament as a secular, just a purely secular book, and we would evaluate its authenticity, its veracity, its truthfulness and accuracy, there wouldn't be any doubt to its legitimacy. But since it is not a secular book and it is a theological book, then therefore it can be and held to a higher standard. And I agree, it needs to be held to a higher standard. If you're going to say something is the word of God, you're going to have to hold it to a higher standard. But when we do hold it to that higher standard, it does meet that test. When we look at three different things here, as far as texts are concerned, not only secular text, but also theological text, you're going to want to look at the time gap between what the events that occurred, and I referred to this earlier, and when these things were recorded, the number of manuscripts that you have, and also the quotes that it has from outside sources. If you go to the time gap, if you look at Suetonius, who lived between 70 AD to 140 AD, and he writes the works called the 12 Caesars, the earliest copy that we have of this is dated 950 AD. That's 800 years. But yet, nobody questions the accuracy or the validity of what is found in those works, the 12 Caesars by Suetonius. Even though, if you look at some of the old ancient writers, they do include metaphysical and supernatural events, but nobody questions those. If you look at Tacitus wrote his history around AD 100. The earliest copy that we have from Tacitus, and people generally accept Tacitus as being authentic, is 1100. That's 1,000 years from the time that he wrote, but yet nobody questions that. What about Pliny? Pliny lives between 61 and 113. The earliest copy that we have from Pliny, the younger, 850 AD, that's 750 years. And look at the number of copies. The one with Tacitus, we got 20 copies. 20 copies. Nobody doubts him. When we look at Pliny, we have 7 copies. Let me see here. You look at Aristotle. Nobody doubts that Aristotle wrote his works. And he lived in 384 to 322 BC. The earliest copy that we have from Aristotle is dated 1100 AD. That's 1400 years. But nobody doubts Aristotle. Nobody doubts what he wrote or that he wrote that. Nobody doubts that events that he opines upon in his writings ever occurred. But yet, they do it with the Bible. If you look at the Bible, you compare that to the John Ryland manuscript, which we also refer to as P51. P51 is dated about AD 130. Now, depending on when you date the Gospel of John, I put the Gospel of John, and I might get myself in trouble here in chat, but I'm going to say it anyway. I put the Gospel of John prior to 67 AD, before 67 AD.
Oh, my God.
And let me tell you why I do that. Okay, in the Gospel of John, you're going to go to chapter 5. Hold on, let's go over to chapter 5, because I want to make sure that I read this verse verbatim. And you go to verse 2, John chapter 5, verse 2. It says, "Now in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, there is a pool in which in Hebrew is called Bethesda, having 5 porticos. In these porticos lay a multitude of those who were sick, blind, limping, or paralyzed." Now, the reason why I say this is because it says now in Jerusalem by the sheep gate, you have this pool, Bethesda, having 5 porticos. Now, these porticos, a portico is like an arch and a covering for people to keep people in the shade, okay? In 67 AD, the Roman legions laid siege to Jerusalem, and they laid siege to Jerusalem from 67 to 70 AD, and Jerusalem was utterly destroyed in 70 AD. And that would included this pool called Bethesda that archaeology has excavated and found when it was destroyed. And this is around 70 AD when the Roman when the Romans laid siege and destroyed Jerusalem. So if John in chapter 5, verse 2 says, "Now in Jerusalem by the sheep gate there is this pool and having 5 porticos," John is speaking as if these still exist. And we know that they didn't exist after 70 AD. So this tells us that the Gospel of John had to be dated prior to that. Okay, so now where am I going with this? Okay, so we're talking about the John Ryland manuscript, which is only the size of a credit card. It's very small, but it contains the Gospel of John, and they date it to 130 AD. This is 60 years from the date of John. If you even put a later date, that would be 30 years. And you start comparing that to other texts of history, 1,000 years from the time it was written to the earliest copy, and you still want to question? You still want to question this? Really? Really? You still want to question this? What about the multiplicity of the texts that we have for the New Testament. We have over 5,600 manuscripts of the New Testament. Now, I get it. A manuscript is nothing more than a handwritten copy of the works. I get that. That's fine. And the majority of them post-date 700, 800 AD. But the fact of the matter is that we have the Alexandrius and the Vaticanus, Textus Vaticanus, all predate the 4th century. So we have complete Bibles clear back before that, and then we have fragments and all kinds of papyri that even go back into the 2nd, 3rd century. So we do have manuscript evidence for the New Testament. And also, oh, by the way, I would add this, the majority of the New Testament was written on papyri, or papyrus. Papyrus is a very fragile, you take the plant papyrus, you flatten it out, you dry it out, and you kind of crisscross it, and then you get your paper. And it'll wear out within 100 years. The fact that we have anything today is an absolute miracle. And couple that with the fact the amount of persecution that the early church suffered and had their manuscripts and all of their text burned, people who possessed them were thrown into the arena to the wild beast and killed. Pastors were taken out and killed. And you're going to complain and say, well, you only have a couple of manuscripts. Shut your pie hole. If that's your standard, you're a historical illiterate. If that's the way you're going to go with that.
Book of John, we have, J. Smith says it's that we can't read like only 17 verses in the whole book of John, and it is 400 years before Muhammad. It is 200 AD.
Right.
Ooh.
Yeah, and to think that people really actually question this, they question the authorship of the Gospels. Really? You're going to question who wrote Matthew? You're going to question who wrote Mark? You're going to question, really? 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 And I got into it with one of these Facebook, I don't want to call him a jihadi. He wasn't a jihadi, but Nematullah. I don't know if you guys have heard of this guy before. I got into it. I was at Planet Fitness one night, sitting on a treadmill. You know him, Rad?
No, I remember that was our first interaction. I challenge Eric the Tougher to a fight.
Right, yeah. I'm like, dude, I'm on a treadmill at Planet Fitness. I don't care. I'm in my car driving around London.
Yeah.
Right.
And I challenge Eric the Tougher. And he would say it in Urdu and Arabic. I challenge Eric the Tougher. Blah, blah, blah.
Well, in one of his mantras was, how do we know that Matthew wrote Matthew? It says the gospel according to Matthew. Well, notice, Nematullah, it doesn't say the gospel according to anybody else. We don't find any of the Gospels, the annotation to any of the Gospels given to anybody else. That's number one. Number two, if we look at, as I said, the contemporaneous people who live contemporaneously with the disciples, Clement of Rome provides attestation. Papias provides attestation. Polycarp provides attestation. Irenaeus provides attestation. And then even when you start getting generations past them, Ignatius does it for all four Gospels, and he lives within a century of
the references for that as well, from what you're saying.
No, go ahead. Now's the great time to do it. Go ahead.
All right, so the Gospels were written by Matthew and John, who were apostles, and Luke and Mark, who were apostolic men. Mark's gospel is the record of Paul's preaching. They tell the same basic facts about Jesus, including the virgin birth. And so to go on. Anyways, the evidence of Clement of Alexandria, around 180, Mark wrote his gospel by request from his knowledge of Peter's preaching at Rome. Matthew and Luke were published first. They are the Gospels containing the genealogies. John's Gospel was the last one to appear. It was written at the urging of his friends. So again, each one is attested to. So far we have Tertullian. We went to Clement of Alexandria. Now we're going to Irenaeus of Lyons. He says that Matthew's Gospel was written, the first one written, it was originally written in the Hebrew dialect. Mark, a disciple of Peter, handed down his gospel what Peter had preached. Luke, a companion of Paul, recorded in a book the gospel preached by him. John, the disciple of the Lord, published a gospel while living in Ephesus in Asia. Note, Irenaeus was a disciple of Polycarp, who was himself a disciple of the Apostle John. So at this point, there is only one human link separating our source from the lifetime of one of Jesus' apostles. Just imagine that for 1 second, people. We have Irenaeus stating that these are the people that wrote the gospel. There is only one human link separating this person from the apostles. How can we not accept this? And of course, he would have got his information from Polycarp, and Polycarp, of course, was a student of John. So therefore, as I don't like to say it because we don't need it, but as Muslims like to say, they have this chain of narration. We have an even better chain of narration than that, and we have, what, over a million quotes of our New Testament from early church fathers. So even if every Bible in the world got burnt, we could recreate it just by the quotes from the early church fathers.
Right, and I was gonna go through the laundry list of that, but I wanted to ask John. I'm gonna put John. Are you there, John? I was gonna put you on the spot.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Here's a question. If you don't know the answer to this, that's okay. When we start looking at the hadith that we find, Sahih Muslim, Sahih Bukhari, Abu Dawud, whoever, when they start saying, when they start going through the chain of narrators, what normally is the average number of narrators that we find in that chain?
I don't have exact number, but let us say it may be 4 or 5, because it's around 200 years after the death of Muhammad. Then logically, it's about 4 or 5 persons in the chain of narration from Muhammad till Muslim or Bukhari.
Okay, so we're talking. All right, so we're talking 4 or 5 narrators attesting to what Muhammad said, and you've juxtaposed that next to what we have is we have people who live contemporaneously with the disciples saying that the disciples did write what we have in our hands today. And then on top of that, here's what I wanted to add to this, and this is why I appreciate you so much, John. When we look at the early church fathers, the early church fathers were a bunch of bloviating old men, meaning they were very long-winded, and they liked to – it's probably they had no life like I do. They can sit there and write all day, and it's not a big deal. But when we look at what they wrote, Tertullian quotes from the New Testament 7,248 times. He lived 160 to 220. Let's see here. Of those 7,000 quotes, 3,800 from the Gospels. Justin Martyr, 330 quotes. Irenaeus, 1,800 quotes. Origen, 17,000 quotes. Hippolytus, 1,300 quotes. Eusebius, 5,100 quotes. You have a total of 36,289 quotes from the early church fathers. Antonicene, early church fathers. Let's just make sure I make sure I got a good definition of that. If you look at what these guys wrote, and you threw away, and let's just play the Islamic game here. If you took all the Qurans and threw them into the ocean and destroyed all the Qurans that we ever did, we could still construct the Quran because of the memorization of the people. Well, that's the same thing is true with the Bible, but it wouldn't be because of memorization. It would be because if you took away all of the New Testaments that we have in writing and all the manuscripts that we have in writing and threw them in the ocean, we could still compile the entire New Testament, with the exception of 11 verses. So when you look at the reliability of the New Testament, you don't have any book from antiquity that comes close. Dan Wallace, who is one of the foremost experts on New Testament manuscripts, calls it, what is that again? A multiplicity of riches or something like that. I can't remember. I always mess that up. But we have 2.5 million pages, 2.5 million pages of New Testament manuscripts.
And let's add something in that point.
Go ahead.
There's a big difference, difference between Bible and Quran, that there is government controlling Quran. Like Osman, all different Quran, different ahruf, and kept only one Quran, that's Quraysh, Dalit or ahruf, but he couldn't make it one, and came after him, Al-Hajjaj, he changed the Quran also, and the Mujahid, and it's all government. The government controls the Quran. But Bible is not like that. Bible was written and made copies and and translated with different languages without any control from the government. You can see Coptic manuscripts, you can see Greek manuscripts, you can see Aramic ones, you can see Latin ones, and all different areas, places, different time is different, but no one collects. In the first researchers, no one collects these manuscripts and burn them or force the early church father to quote these quotations. They are quoting each church father is in a different place, and they are not connected. There was no internet at the time. They are not connected together. Then this good this gives good validity for Bible more over the Quran. This is my opinion.
And,
great opinion too.
And I like that point that the government controlled controlled the manuscript and what was be put out there. But when you look at the Bible, there was no controlling authority there. There was no overreaching authority that controlled what could be in the Bible versus what was in the Quran. So that even lends more credibility to the Bible. And also, oh by the way, I would point out that we don't have any of the original writings of the Quran either, because what happened? Who knows what happened? I'm playing teacher here. Who knows what happened to the original manuscripts of the Quran?
Hey, depends on which one you want to talk about, because I got to jump in here for a second.
Go ahead,
Chris. You said we only had about 11 missing verses when we reconstructed the whole New Testament out of the Church Father references, right?
Right.
That's actually less than what the goat ate of the Quran.
What the goat ate is what you said. Okay.
The goat ate more ayats in the Quran than we have.
Never thought of it that way. That's hilarious. That she goat. Oh my goodness. What if it would have been a male goat? Why do they have to call it a she goat?
Because women are half as smart as male. So they're thinking that the male goat, known better than the female goat, was half as smart and just did that. That's the only logic that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. They couldn't blame it on the male. They couldn't blame it on the female, the woman.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, abrogated. Read the chat. They were abrogated. I'm sorry. That's what. Yeah. Gosh, you guys are too funny. I had to hang out with you more often. Somebody asked, can anyone recommend a trustworthy book or source where I can read to learn the facts that you and I are talking about? There are several books out there, and I got way too many books, according to the Queen. As a matter of fact, she's had me move half, I would say, 70% of my library out to the barn because I just have too many books. Any book that you would find probably from Dan Wallace talking about manuscript evidence. I don't have a book of his, I don't believe, on my shelf in here right now, but anything by Dan Wallace would suffice for that. Or if you could go to his website, let me look that up. Chris, if you have something to add while I look this up, I'd appreciate that.
The only thing that I'd add for you too, and thank you very much for that question. I think it's very important for people to do this. Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, I don't care who you are. I would be studying the writings of Ignatius. Athanasius, right, studying the writings of Clement of Rome, studying the writings that we still have of Polycarp, studying the writings of Tertullian, because within those writings is what they say about our scripture, and that's where I was getting it from. So again, to a lot of people out there, I have my own Google Drive where I store thousands of dissertations and different articles that people write that I just don't want to keep going back to the internet for. So I download and I put it on my Google Drive. So I have a bunch of stuff like that in there, things to that nature. But what I would do is I would definitely go and read the early church father material. Now, there's a ton of it, so good luck.
Yeah, and I just posted Dan Wallace's website here. It's called the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. And he has not only high-resolution photos of the manuscripts that we have, but there's several articles on here that talk about, you know, where they come from, what are the reliabilities of them, you know, their origins and things of that nature. And it's just a really good website. And it's kind of fun to have. To go in and look at some of these writings, it tells you how many different copies of certain manuscripts there are. So if you go in there and you look at that, there are also other books out there. Mike Lacona and Gary Habermas do some work on there.
They
you know,
do that on the resurrection, though, don't they?
Yeah, yeah, they focus on that, but they do talk
Gary
about
Habermas, the resurrection of Jesus. I also have Gary Habermas, The Evidence for the Historical Jesus, mm-hmm. and I also have Michael Lacona's dissertation that he then turned into his book. So I have all those three in my Google Drive.
Yeah, and those two are just great contemporaneous apologists. I looked at SlamRN said, hold on, everybody look at this quote that she has. She milked, I milked goats on a farm. Slam, you and I share that experience, and if you ever play the game of life, you get like life tiles for doing certain things in your life, and milking a goat is one of those. So both of us provide or have a life tile because we both milked goats.
I tried milking a bull once. It didn't end well for the bull, I'm just saying.
Jeez.
That one went left field.
That.
I had to throw that in there. That was just because. No, I got a joke where it says, "Oh, you believe that there are more than two genders? Go milk a bull and see what happens." So. You know.
Oh my god. Okay. Hey, here's. Let me see here. I have four papers here. Matthew, who wrote Matthew? Who wrote John? There's a reason why I have four. Who wrote Luke and who wrote Mark? And you can, I'm fixing to tell you. My Southern coming out here. I'm fixing to tell y'all. You go to answeringislam.org. So let me write this into chat because I want to make sure you guys get this. Answering, is that -islam.org? Is that Sam's site? I think that's Sam's site, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's a site that Sam.
Authors/Thompson/Gmail. Gospel. Underscore. No, is that underscore? Underscore.
I don't know if anybody out there knows Protestant Believer. If you all have questions about any of the past teachings that Sam has on his channel, Protestant Believer actually has a directory of videos and has references beside every video, so he knows exactly what teaching is in every video. So if you have a question about a certain teaching, wonder if Sam has it, contact Protestant Believer. He can get you to the right one.
Okay. Only occurs if you have thumb scars because you have to pull down on the udders. For goats, Rad, not for the bull. Let me just make sure we understand that. Okay, I posted that link in chat if you all want to look that up. Okay, yeah, and we appreciate you doing that too, come to think about it. Okay, folks, we are at the end of the show. I hope I know. It's kind of sad, but we have
can
to go.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, Connie. I didn't see that. Let me add this up here. Wow, this is. Let me just let you know, Connie does a lot of memes. She is kind of this. She kind of has the what we call obsessive compulsive disorder when it comes to that, as you can see. But she makes some great memes. Okay, what did you want to show us, Connie? Go ahead.
Okay, look at this. Sahih Muslim 168 wrote the NGO in Arabic. This was about Wadaka. Okay, so that means that we had the Injil in Muhammad's time. And Sahih al-Bukhari, 3392, that the name Wadaka, that he used to read the Gospels, plural. Okay.
Wadaka. Wadaka was the Nestorian, who's Wadaka? Who is Wadaka? I'm getting mixed up here.
He was Khadija's uncle.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, he was. Did they think he was an historian, Christian? Though, yeah, that's what I'm asking. It doesn't matter.
You know better than me.
He confirmed Muhammad's prophethood. That's kind of ironic that a Christian would have confirmed that Muhammad was a prophet.
Yeah. Okay, and then this is Hadith. I don't have the number here, but it says the same thing. That he used to write the Gospels in Arabic. So there's, and I want to show you one more. And you can just look up those words in Gospels. You just put Gospels in the Sunnah. And
yeah, hey, Connie, they're saying in chat that they can't see your memes.
Oh, you can't see my memes?
We can see the list of them, but we can't read them because they're way too small.
Okay, let me click on it again and let me zoom in. Can y'all see it now?
No.
No?
No.
What's going on? Okay, let me get out. And
you're sharing your screen, right? Because we see this laundry list of memes that you have. It says confirms the Bible. We can't read the memes themselves.
Let me just share one. Okay, now I got to jump in there. And then I'll just share this one since, let me go back and so you guys can see everything. Were you able to see the first one okay?
No, we weren't. No, we were just looking. At that list that you had there. Sorry.
Okay. No, yeah. Okay, so let me share this one. Let me share this different way then. Okay, that's that one. Okay.
All right. Yep, we can see this now. Let me bring it up.
So
there we go.
If we zoom in. You can see that
there you go.
About that Wadaka, there is Wadaka bin Nawfal, that he wrote the Injil in Arabic. And so that lets you know that, yes, the Injil, which we all know is the gospel, that Muhammad had it in his time, and that is Sahih Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, 168.
Mm-hmm.
This is Sahih al-Bukhari, 3392. And this is still about Wadaka. He used to read the Gospels. So it's also in, so here we go. This just shows you, if you put them together, if you piecemeal the stuff together, the Injil is the Gospels.
Right. So this idea, this fabrication that the Injil is something else is not consistent with what their original sources say. And you're right.
To their early Muslim believers. You know, I've come to respect a lot of these early Muslim believers, you know, because they are telling the truth. It is Gospels, you know.
Right, and it's not convoluted by, contemporaneous.
Right. And I also have another one, but I won't share it, but I'll just tell you that George Sells, he lived in India. He was a Muslim. He translated the Quran. In his index, he says the four real gospels.
Mm-hmm.
The four real gospels. And I was like, oh, wow. So I just, screenshotted it and made a little picture, too. And that was in the 1700s. So what we're getting from...
Well, maybe this... Yeah, and I don't know. John, maybe John would know. Is this idea that the Injil that is mentioned in the Quran, is this a recent phenomena that it's supposed to be different than what the fourfold gospel is, or is this something that has always been taught?
Actually, it happens when the Muslim begin to read the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, and searching the name of Muhammad in Bible, they couldn't find it. Then they say that it's corrupted, or the Injil and Torah are different from ours today or at this time. This appeared lately, not with old Sahaba or something. No, it's later, maybe 200 years after.
Okay, so it's been what you're saying, it's been around for since how long?
200 years. No one said that the Injil is corrupted. I didn't see that in any Sahaba or Tabi'i, the companions of Muhammad. No one said that. Maybe 200 years when Muslims begin to read the Bible.
Oh, so they start realizing that it contradicts it.
It's corrupted, yes.
Okay, so when they start realizing and say, hey, wait a second,
yeah,
this isn't true. This doesn't line up. This contradicts it. Okay, so that makes sense. All right, hey, folks, we are out of time. Well, we're not out of time, but I am. I'm wore out. Adam was on me last time he was on here about, why are you only doing an hour and a half? I do 3 hours. Well, number one, you're 20 years younger than I am. But number two, you don't teach school children that wear you out. Rob K., I see that you showed up here, and thank you for coming. And then Slam RN, thank you again. I didn't give you a shout out earlier. I see that you come. Everybody else that came tonight, thank you again. This tonight's show has been a lot of fun, and I appreciate you coming in and participating, and contributing to what we can demonstrate is the truth, not only from a theological perspective, but also a historical perspective. And for me, and I'm going to give you the 411, I do not, I'm going to say this, and you might be shocked, but I don't have a lot of faith. I find it very hard to believe people. I find it very hard to believe things that, you know, faith is the hope of things unseen, and those hopeful, you know, I have a hard time doing that. And one of the things that I spend most of my time doing is searching out for evidence. So it doesn't have to be a faith or a blind faith on top of that. And when you look at Islam, it is indeed a spiritually blinded faith. But when you look at Christianity, we have so much evidence, not only for the existence, I mean, just looking around us, when we look at natural theology, just around us, God's creation just rings so true. And I've spent a lot of years talking about this evolution idea of, and you know, pure materialism and naturalism versus theological causation. I've done that. But now when we start looking at the special revelation that we get from God, we can trust the New Testament. We can trust with those what we find in the Bible. And the Bible tells us something very clear. It tells us something that we as human beings have a hard time accepting and understanding, that God loves us so very much that he gave his only son to die for our sins in our stead as a sacrificial atonement. And my prayer has always been and will always be that Muslims come to understand that idea, because it's like a stumbling block. The Bible describes it as a stumbling block for them, and it breaks my heart to see that. And this is one of the reasons why I dedicate, you know, hours of my life each week to coming. Plus, I enjoy coming on here and dealing with, you know, you guys are right too. I just want to make sure we say that. But this is one of the reasons why I do this, is because I want them to be reached with the truth. But also what I want to do, and this is one of the more important reasons, is that I want to edify the body of believers. And tonight I think we just gave you what we would call in the South a butt ton of evidence to do that. So We're going to close it up. Everybody, again, thank you for so much for coming, spending your evening with us. I know there's a ton of things that you could also be doing besides listening to some old man run his yip. What? Isa, are you there, sir? Hello?
I am here. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
You have a beautiful smile. Look at you.
He does. He's a great-looking young guy. Hey, Isa, I wanted to tell you that that this show got nailed last week for copyright infringement from playing – Connie's probably going to love this. We got hit with a copyright infringement for playing Hell's Bells. So what I want to do is I spent a little time this week looking for some music that you can freeware or whatever that you don't have to have copyright. And then what I'm going to need is I'm going to write up a script that goes along with the playing of this. Like, this is Radio Free Kafiristan brought to you from Darhar Karb Kafiristan in the cavernous cave. Let's pull that old codger out of that cave and see what – or something on those lines. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to do that if I sent that to you.
Sure. Fine. You want me to do like a voice recording?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
That's fine. You can give it to me, and I can talk like this.
Yeah. However you want to do it, brother. No, whatever you think is best. Cool. But it's got to sound cool though. And I know you got a lot of cool points over me because I'm old. But you can do it. You know, and that might be it. Might be the accent. Might be the answer to our prayers here. Okay. So what did you want? I'm sorry for getting you off topic. Did you want to say something special tonight?
I'm just glad to be here. You know, I like try to come every week. It's been hard. I'm getting certified to becoming a teacher now, so it's a lot of work.
Why would you want to do that? Gosh, can't you see what this is what happens after you start being a teacher? Why would you want to look at my – it's turning white.
I wanted to ask you, how is it to be like a history teacher? Like, what kind of – how is that like for you? Is it like – What's your particular field? Do you do like American history?
I'm American history. I teach American history, early American history, from colonization all the way up to, as a matter of fact, tomorrow we start Reconstruction. We tested on the Civil War today. And my students, I'm going to brag on them a little bit, scored the highest in the county in the aggregate as for our test. So way to go. But I love teaching. I really do. I love the content. You have to love the content. Like, if I was – like, I taught science for 2 years. I thought, well, you know, you love science. Not so much. I did not like it as much as I loved history. History is my wheelhouse because, you know, I have a passion for it. I have a and more importantly, I have a passion for my – I love my country. And if you're going to teach American history, this crap that they're shoveling today – and where's Rad? Rad's gone. But him and I have talked about this. Some of the things that they have out there and some of the curriculum they have out there is just impossible. But you have to love kids too. And some kids are harder to love than others. And you have to be able to, I can tell you have to be able to develop a level. And I don't know if it comes through in the show or not, but you have to have a level of patience with people, with kids, and try to understand. You know, some kids, they drop the F-bomb in your class, and you're like, what did you say? You can't do that. You're only an eighth grader. But, you know, the problem is that some of those households that those kids come from, they've heard it 20 times before they even got dropped off for school that morning. So it makes it kind of hard to – so in other words, you have to have a lot of empathy for people. You have to be able to understand where they come from and compassion. But it is one of the most rewarding jobs that you can have.
WWJD, right? So
there you go. Yeah. As a matter of fact, every time I get the chance, you never guess what we talk about. The Bible. We talk about what a Christian nation is, and some of the Christian principles that we find in our founding documents. Who inspired who? And this idea that Jefferson. I'm not going to get into. Never mind. We got to go. We're 10 minutes over tonight.
When you think interested in like the creation museum type of science, like Ken Hovind, or do you have a different perspective?
No. I don't believe that our our universe popped into existence 14.6 billion years ago. I don't believe our Earth is 4.6 billion years old. I believe that the geological stratas that we find today are consistent with what we would call the Noetic Deluge, Noah's Flood. I believe that a lot of the fossils that we find in the ground are consistent with what we would find with the worldwide flood. So I would say I'm more I can't hold, you know, I love Ken Hovind. That guy, even though he spent 9 years in jail, I still love the brother. Yeah, it's for tax evasion. Who goes to jail for tax evasion for 9 years anyway? But
speaking kind of a religious point of why he didn't want to pay taxes, that's what I think the position was. He was making some kind of philosophical religious position. I went to the Creation Museum in Kentucky. It's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, have you been to the Ark? Oh, I've been there. I've been there a couple times. Have you been to the Ark?
Before the Ark was built. I was
okay.
Going to go to the Ark when it was in construction. So
you need I am a big supporter of not only personally but financially. I supported that. I have my name in a couple of the bricks up there at the museum, and out at the Ark. Yeah, I've given. The Queen of Kafiristan is not happy with it, but her name's on it too, so she ought to be. But I was going to say that when they opened the Ark, I think he opened the Ark way too soon, and the reason why he opened the Ark way too soon is because we went in there, there was just too much empty space. They did not have enough displays or information. But now, as time's going, I haven't been there for 3-4 years. But from my understanding is that they've filled it up, and which rightly so, and they're building other things out there that I'd like to get down there and see in the future. But that's my perspective when I was teaching science. And the thing was is that, and I'll admit this, that when we were talking about homology as far as bone structures are concerned, well, you know, this demonstrates that this species evolved into this species, and we were talking about I can't remember the name of the amphibians, not the amphibians, the fish that evolved into mammals that walked upon the earth and then went back into the ocean, and you start pointing out these thigh bones and stuff like that. And I said, okay, can you tell me how these things are related? And then you would show them the size of them, and the students are like, well, that's kind of stupid. And I'm, oh, no, hold on a second. This is science. Don't you dare be questioning the science behind this. And they would see how I was forcing them to actually think critically about what is taught. And I think they appreciate that. Students, they can see that and they can start appreciating that, especially when you start telling them fairy tales. There's a guy that He used to be in charge of the microscope lab at California Berkeley, UC California Berkeley. His name's Mark Armitage, and him and I have had numerous discussions. And what he discovered a Triceratops horn up in the I think it's the Badlands up in Montana, but a Triceratops horn in a foot and a half of mud. And him and Kevin Anderson, who publishes for its organization out of Prescott, Arizona, I can't remember the name of the journal, but they call. And here's the thing: this is why I bring this up. The horn was not fossilized. Number one, Triceratops are thought to be extinct 70 million years ago, and this thing's in a foot and a half of Montana mud, and it's not fossilized. How does that ever happen? Number one. Number two, within this horn itself, they find osteocytes, cells. Think about that. You find cells still existent. And on these cells, they have, on bone cells, you have really fine fibers that come off them called filopodia. And it still has that. Now, how does that happen? If these organisms died out 70 million years ago, which they know for a fact, how does that happen? And they've done C14 testing on it, And, you know, okay, you're getting, I'm getting off on a complete tangent here, but I could talk all night about this because I absolutely love, I love Answers in Genesis ministry and what they do and how they clearly demonstrate the validity of what we would take the Bible as history, how they do that.
Yeah, it's a nice place. It's really, I don't think the taxes go bad to be there. Like, some people were complaining when I was there, they were upset that they were paying for, you know, some of the taxes of Kentucky were going there. But I'm like, it's a beautiful museum, you know, and a lot of people in Kentucky are Christian. So, I mean, I do think it probably serves a lot of the people in Kentucky anyway. So I don't see why.
The taxes weren't going to the museum itself. They were given tax breaks where they weren't required for a number of years to pay a certain percentage of their taxes to the state of Kentucky based on the revenue that the state would generate from people visiting the museum. And the number of people visiting the museum and the Ark Encounter has exponentially outgrown any previous prediction that had been given before. So the state of Kentucky is making butt tons more money than what they could have possibly thought that they would have gotten if they hadn't given these tax breaks. So I can understand people's objection to it. Oh, it's a religious organization. But from a financial perspective, it makes perfectly good sense because they've made all kinds of money for the state of Kentucky.
Well, and also a lot of people in Kentucky are Christian too. So I'm like, which are probably most of the people there are believers in that. So I'm like, I don't think it's a bad thing for them, you know?
That's one way to look at it, and I agree wholeheartedly with you. Okay, guys, I got to go, but thanks for coming, and I appreciate the conversation, and I really appreciate you guys. So God bless you, and we'll see y'all soon. Okay, so I'm ending this broadcast, or at least I think I am, and I'm leaving the studio, and my peeps over here on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you for coming. Annie, I saw you in chat. I saw you over there on our YouTube stream. Thank you for coming. All right. God bless everybody. We'll see you next week on Radio Free Kafiristan.